He can find his way anywhere. He'd be here if he wasn't dead. Then she broke down again. He's dead. He's dead. I know it, she said. That goddamn hump man got him.
If he wasn't dead, I'd shoot him, or Wallace won, Caleb said. I lost my dog and both my scouts in the same day. Why it would take two scouts to track one antelope buck is a conundrum.
Say that again, a what?
Long Bill asked. Brognoli sat beside him, his head still jerking, his look still glassy-eyed. In the moments when his head stopped jerking, it was twisted at an odd angle on his neck.
A conundrum, Caleb repeated. I visited Harvard College once and happened to learn the word.
What does it mean, sir? Call asked.
I believe it's Latin, Gus said.
One of his sisters had given him a Latin lesson in the afternoon once, and he was anxious to impress Caleb Cobb with his mental powers. Perhaps he'd make sergeant yet.
Oh, are you a scholar, Mr. McCrae? Caleb asked.
No, but I still believe it's Latin. I've had lessons, Gus said.
The lessons part was a lie. After one lesson of 30 minutes duration, he had given up the Latin language forever.
Well, I heard it in Boston, and Boston ain't very Latin, Caleb said. Conundrum is a thing you can't figure out. What I can't figure out is why two scouts would go after one antelope.
Two's better than one out here, Long Bill said. I wouldn't want to go walking off without somebody with me who knew the way back.
If Shad ain't dead, he's left, Matilda said. He was talking about leaving anyway.
Left to do what? Caleb asked. We're on the Staked Plains. All there is to do is wander.
Left. Just left, Matilda said. I guess he didn't want to take me with him. Then Matilda broke down. She sobbed deeply for a while, and then her sobs turned to howls. Her whole body shook, and she howled and howled, as if she were trying to howl up her guts. In the emptiness of the prairies, the howls seemed to hover in the air. They made the men uneasy. It was as if a great she-wolf were howling, only the she-wolf was in their midst. No one could understand it. Shadrach had gone off to kill an antelope buck, and Matilda was howling, a woman abandoned. Many of the men shifted a little, wishing the woman would just be quiet. She was a whore. No one had asked her to form an attachment to old Shadrach anyway. He was a mountain man. Mountain men were born to wander. Several men had been hoping Matilda would become a whore again. They had a long walk ahead. A little coupling would at least be a diversion. But hearing her howl, the same men, Long Bill among them, began to have second thoughts. The woman was howling like a beast, and a frightening beast at that. Coupling with her would be risky. Besides, old Shadrach might not be gone. He might return at an inconvenient time and take offense. Caleb Cobb was unaffected by Matilda's howling. He was eating a piece of horse meat. He glanced at Matilda from time to time. It amused him that the troop had become so uneasy just because a woman was crying. Love, with all its mystery, had arrived in their midst, and they didn't like it. A whore had fallen in love with an old man of the mountains. It wasn't supposed to happen, but it had. The men were unnerved by it. Such a thing was unnecessary, even unnatural. Even the Comanches, in a way, worried them less. Comanches did what they were expected to, which was kill whites. It might mean war to the death, but at least there was no uncertainty about what to expect. But here was a woman howling like a she-wolf. What sense did that make? Love's a terrible price to pay for company, ain't it, Matty? Caleb said. I won't pay it myself. I'd rather do without the company. One by one, the exhausted men fell asleep. Gus wanted to play cards. There was rarely a night when the urge for card playing didn't come over him. But the men ignored him. They didn't want to play cards when they had nothing to play for, and were thirsty anyway. It was pointless to play cards when Buffalo Hump and his warriors might be about to hurl down on them, and Johnny Carthage said as much.
Well, they ain't here now. Why can't we play a few hands?
Gus asked, annoyed that his friends were such sleepyheads. The men didn't even answer. They just ignored him. For a while, once Matty's howls subsided, the only sound in camp was the sound of shuffling cards. Gus shuffled and shuffled the deck to keep his hands busy. Call took the guard. He went away from camp a little ways to stand it. He preferred to be apart at night to think over the day's action, if there was action. It might be that he would command a troop someday. He wanted to learn,
and yet he had no teachers. He was on his second expedition as a ranger, and nothing on either expedition had been well planned. In all their encounters with the Indians had outplanned them and outfought them by such a margin that it was partly luck that any of them survived. Call couldn't understand it.
Caleb Cobb had spoken of Harvard College, and Major Chevalier had been at West Point. Call knew little about Harvard College, but he did know that West Point was where generals and colonels were trained. If these men had such good schooling, why didn't they plan better? It was worrisome. Now they were out in the middle of a big plain, and no one seemed to know much about where they were going or how to survive until they got there. No one knew how to find water reliably or what plants they could eat if they had to eat plants. It was fine to rely on game if there was game, but what if there wasn't? Even old Jesus, the Mexican blacksmith in San Antonio, knew more about plants than any one of the rangers, though maybe not more than Sam had known. It was obviously wrong to allow only one or two men in a troop to be keepers of all the knowledge that the troop needed for survival. Sam had known how to doctor, but he'd fallen over a cliff and no one had bothered to get instructions from him about how to treat various wounds. Call had been made a little uneasy by Matilda's howling, but he was not as affected by it as most of the other men. Probably she would stop crying when she wore out. Probably she would get up and be herself again the next day. Call liked Matilda. She'd been helpful to him on more than one occasion. The fact that she had fastened on Shadrach to love was a matter beyond his scope. People could love whom they pleased, he supposed. That was excusable. What wasn't excusable, in his view, was setting off on a long, dangerous expedition without adequate preparation. He resolved that if he ever got to lead Rangers, he would see that each man under his command received clear training and sound instruction, so they would have a chance to survive if the commander was lost. Call enjoyed his guard time. Now that there were no horses to steal, the Indians would not need to come around, unless it was to murder them. He could see no reason for them to risk a direct attack. The Rangers had no water and little food. It was hundreds of miles to where they were going, and no one knew the way. The Comanches didn't need to put themselves at risk just to destroy the Rangers. The country would do the job for them. He liked sitting apart from the camp, listening to the night sounds from the prairie. Coyotes howled, and other coyotes answered them. Occasionally he would hear the scratchings of small animals, hunting birds, hawks, or owls, passed overhead. Sometimes Call wished that he could be an Indian for a few days, or at least find a friendly Indian who could train him in their skills. The Comanches, on two nights, had stolen 30 horses from a well-guarded place. He would have liked to go along with the horse thieves on such a raid to see how they did it. He wanted to know how they could creep into a horse herd without disturbing it. He wanted to know how they could take the horses out without being seen or heard. He knew, though, that no Indian was likely to come along and offer to instruct him. He would just have to watch and learn. It annoyed him that Gus McCrae had so little interest in the skills needed for rangering. All Gus thought of was whores, cards, and the girl in the general store in Austin. If Gus had been carrying his rifle correctly, he could have killed the buck antelope and the troop would not have lost its scouts. Just before dawn, with the night peaceful, Call relaxed and dozed for a minute. Though it seemed only minutes that he dozed, his awakening was rude. Someone yanked his head back by the hair and drew a finger across his throat.
"They say you don't feel a knife that cuts your throat," Bigfoot said. "If I had been a Comanche, you'd be dead."
Call was badly embarrassed. He had been caught asleep. It was only just beginning to be light. He saw Shadrach a little distance behind Bigfoot. The old man was leading three horses.
"Yep, we found three nags," Bigfoot said. "I guess they were lucky and found a thin patch of fire."
"We thought you were dead," Call told him. "Matty was upset about Shad."
"Shad's fine. He wants to go look for more horses," Bigfoot said. "Three nags won't carry this troop to New Mexico."
Caleb Cobb gave the returning scouts a stony welcome. A rattlesnake had crawled across him during the night and disturbed his sleep. His temper was foul, and he didn't bother to conceal the fact.
"Nobody told you to go chasing antelope," he said. "But since you went, where's the meat? If I still had chains, I'd put them on you."
The carcass of the little antelope was slung across one of the recaptured horses. Shadrach pulled it off and pitched it at Caleb's feet. He was angry, but Bigfoot Wallace was angrier. Few of the men had seen Bigfoot's temper rise,
but those who had knew to lean far back from it. His face had grown red and his eyes menacing as he stood before Caleb Cobb. "You wouldn't put no damn chains on me, I guess," he said. "I won't be chained, not by you and not by any man." "You ain't no colonel," he added. "You're nothing but a land pirate. They run you off the sea, so now you're out here trying to pirate Santa Fe. I've took my last orders from you, Mr. Cobb, and Shadrach feels the same." Caleb calmly stood up and drew his big knife. "Let's fight," he said. "We'll see how hard you are to chain once I cut your goddamn throat." In an instant, Bigfoot's knife was out. He was ready to start slashing at Caleb Cobb, but before the fight started, old Shadrach slipped between them. He grabbed two pistols from Gus and pointed one at each combatant. "No cutting," he said. The pistols were pointed at each man's chest. Shadrach's action was so unexpected that it chilled the fury in Caleb and Bigfoot. "You goddamn fools," Shadrach said. "We need every man we can get. I'll do the killing if there's killing to be done." Caleb and Bigfoot lowered their knives. Both looked a little sheepish, but the menace was not entirely gone. "We best save up to fight the Comanches," Shadrach said, handing Gus back his guns.
"All right," Caleb said, "but I don't tolerate mutiny. I still give the orders, Wallace."
"Give better ones, then," Bigfoot said. "I wouldn't waste a fart on your damn orders." Most of the rangers were black to the waist from tramping through 5 miles of sooty grass. They had used up all the water in their canteens and were already feeling thirst, although it was early morning and still cool. Bigfoot and Shadrach had seen no water while tracking the antelope. Old Shadrach's beard had red smudges on it. He had cut the little antelope's throat and drunk some of its blood. "I wonder who gets to ride the horses," Gus asked. "I guess we ought to let Johnny ride one. He's so gimpy he can't keep up." Indeed, the walk across the hot grass had been an ordeal for Johnny Carthage. In the course of the march, he had fallen almost an hour behind the troop. He knew that he would have been easy prey for a Comanche. He struggled so to keep up that he exhausted himself and simply lay down and went sound asleep once he finally struggled to the outskirts of camp. Call had heard his wheezy snores as he stood guard. "There's probably more horses that didn't get scorched," Gus said. Call didn't answer. One or two more horses would not solve their problems. The sun had come up, lighting the plain far to the west and north. On the farthest edge, little white clouds lined the horizon. The plain was absolutely empty. Call saw no animals, no birds, no trees, no river courses, no Indians, nothing. "Who do you think would have won if Caleb and Bigfoot had fought?" Gus asked. "Shadrach would have won," Call said. "He would have killed them both." "That wasn't what I meant," Gus said, but Call had turned away. Long Bill was cooking the antelope and the meat smelled good. He wanted a slice before the meat was all gone. One little antelope wouldn't go far, not with so many hungry men. "Carry your gun right today," Call told Gus when the march started. "We might see another antelope and we can't afford another miss." "I won't miss next time," Gus said. The next day they found 4 more horses. 2 had serious burns, but 2 were healthy. Caleb killed the 2 burned horses and dried their meat. In the afternoon, they found a tiny, muddy depression on the plain with a little scummy water in it. The depression was full of frogs and tadpoles. Though the water was greenish, the rangers drank it anyway. Some of the men immediately vomited it back up. They were thirsty and yet could not keep the water down. The next morning, Caleb decided to divide the troop.
"Corporal Call and Corporal McCrae can go with you, Wallace," Caleb said. "Take 3 horses and try to reach the settlements. Ride night and day, but rest your mounts every 3 hours. Look for a village called Anton Chico. You ought to strike it first."
"Who gets the other horses?" Long Bill asked.
"I'll take one and Shadrach can take the other," Caleb said. "We'll travel parallel to one another as best we can. Some of us ought to strike water."
"What if we don't?" Johnny asked.
"I guess we can pray," Caleb replied. "God might send a rainstorm."
Neither Call nor Gus had expected to be separated from the troop. Both had become good friends with Jimmy Tweed, who had managed to keep a lively attitude despite all that had happened. When Long Bill and Blackie Slidell sang at night, Jimmy would always join in.
Tommy Spencer, the youngster from Missouri, sat and listened. Johnny Carthage bemoaned the fact that he had no way to get drunk. He suffered from fearsome nightmares and liked to dull himself with liquor before they began. The boys were a group within the larger group, and it was hard to leave them. Gus was wishing Matilda would come with their party. Sometimes she mothered him when he was feeling sorry for himself. He didn't see why old Shadrach should get all the mothering.
"If you're captured by the Mexicans, keep quiet," Caleb said as they were leaving.
"Keep quiet about what?" Bigfoot asked.
"Don't tell them our numbers," Caleb said. "Let them think there's 1,000 of us out here."
Bigfoot looked around at the blackened, exhausted men, many of them already so thirsty that their tongues were thick in their mouths.
"I ain't gonna be bragging about no mighty army," Bigfoot said. "Half of you may be dead before we find anybody to report to."
He rode a few steps west and then turned his horse.
"Getting captured may be the only way any of you will stay alive," he said. "If I could get you captured, I'd do it right now."
Then he turned and loped off to the northwest. Gus and Carl waved at Long Bill and the others and loped after him. As they rode, the space ahead of them seemed to get wider and emptier. Gus looked back after a few minutes of riding for one last look at the troop and found that it had vanished. The big plain had engulfed them. Though it looked level, there were many shallow dips and gentle rolls. Gus made sure he kept up. He didn't want to lag and get lost. The sky was so deep and so vast that it took away his sense of direction. Even when he was looking directly at the sun, he had no confidence that he really knew which way he was going. They rode 6 hours without seeing a moving object other than the waving grass and one or two jackrabbits. Carl had a sense of trespass as he rode. He felt that he was in a country that wasn't his. He didn't know where Texas stopped and New Mexico began, but it wasn't the Texans or the New Mexicans whose country he was riding through. It was the Comanches he trespassed on. Watching them move across the face of the canyon on a trail so narrow that he couldn't see it had shown him again that the Comanches were the masters of their country to a degree no ranger could ever be. Not one horse or one Comanche had fallen or even stumbled as they walked across the cliff face. The rangers had been on foot and had plenty of handholds when they went over the edge, and yet several had fallen to their deaths. The Indians could do things white men couldn't do. He mentioned as much to Bigfoot, who shrugged.
"We'll be beyond them pretty soon," he said. "We'll be moving into the Apache country. We may be in it already. They ain't no better, but they don't have so many horses, so they're slower. Most Apaches are foot Indians."
"Oh, well, I expect I could outrun them then," Gus said. "I could if I see them before they stab me or something. I've always been fleet."
"You won't see them before they stab you, though," Bigfoot said. "The Apaches hide better than the Comanches, and that's saying something. An Apache could hide under a cow turd if that's all there was."
A minute or two later, they saw a dot on the horizon. The dot didn't seem to be moving. Bigfoot thought it might be a wagon. Carl couldn't see it at all and grew annoyed with his own eyes. Why wouldn't they look as far as other men's eyes? Gus, whose eyesight was the pride of the troop, ruled out the possibility that the dot was a wagon. When he looked hard, the dot seemed to dance in his vision. At times it became 2 or 3 dots, but it never became a wagon.
"No, if it was a wagon, there'd be mules or horses," Gus said. "Or there'd be people. But there ain't no mules or horses, and I don't see the people."
"It could just be a lump of dirt," Bigfoot said. "I've heard that out in New Mexico you'll find piles of dirt sticking up. I expect that's one of them."
But when they were a mile or two closer, Gus saw the dot move. A lump of dirt might stick up, but shouldn't move. He galloped ahead, anxious to be the one to identify whatever they were seeing, and he did identify it. It was a solitary buffalo bull.
"Well, there's meat. Let's kill it," Bigfoot said, pulling his rifle.
Almost as he said it, the buffalo saw them coming and began a lumbering retreat. It seemed to be moving so slowly that Carl was confident they would come up on it in a minute or two, but again, appearances deceived him. The buffalo looked slow, but the horses they were riding were no faster. They had had thin grazing and were gaunt and tired. Even at a dead run, they scarcely gained on the buffalo. They had to run the animal almost 3 miles to close within rifle range, and then it was a long rifle range. At 30 yards, they all began to fire, and to reload and fire again, and yet again.
but the buffalo didn't fall, stop, or even stagger. It just kept running at the same lumbering pace on and on over the empty plain. 3 times the rangers closed with the buffalo, whipping their tired horses to within 20 feet of it. They emptied their rifles at almost point-blank range several times, and they didn't miss. Gus could see the tufts of brown hair fly off when the heavy bullets hit. Yet the buffalo didn't fall or even flinch. It just kept running at the same steady pace.
"Boys, we better stop," Bigfoot said after the third charge. "We're running our horses to death for nothing. That buffalo's got 15 bullets in him, and he ain't even slowed down."
"Why won't the goddamn animal fall?" Gus said, highly upset. He was angered by the perversity of the lone buffalo. By every law of the hunt, it should have fallen. 15 bullets ought to be enough to kill anything, even an elephant, even a whale. The buffalo wasn't even very large. It ought to fall, and yet perversely, it wouldn't. It seemed to him that everything in Texas was that way. Indians popped out of bare ground or from the sides of hills disguised as mountain goats. Snakes crawled in people's bedrolls, and thorns in the brush country were as poisonous as snake bites once they got in you. It was all an aggravation in his view. Back in Tennessee, beast and man were much better behaved. But they weren't in Tennessee. They were on an empty plain chasing a slow brown animal that should long since have been dead. Determined to kill it once and for all, Gus spurred his tired horse into a frantic burst of speed and ran right up beside the buffalo. He fired, with his rifle barrel no more than a foot from the buffalo's heaving ribs, and yet the animal ran on. Gus drew rein. His horse was staggered and fired again. The buffalo kept running.
"Whoa now, whoa," Bigfoot cautioned. "We better give up, else we'll kill all our horses."
Call tried a long shot and thought he hit the buffalo right where its heart should be, but the buffalo merely lost a step or two and then resumed its heavy run.
"I expect it's a witch buff," Bigfoot said, dismounting to rest his tired horse.
"A what?" Gus asked. He had never heard of a witch buff.
"I expect the hump man put a spell on it," Bigfoot said. "It's got 25 bullets in it now, maybe 30. If it wasn't a witch buff, we'd be eating its liver already."
"Indians can make spells," he added. "They're a lot better at it than white folks. Buffalo Hump is a war chief, but he's got some powerful medicine men in the tribe. I expect he sent this buffalo out here to make us use up all our ammunition."
"Why, how would he do that?" Gus asked, startled by the concept.
"Praying and dancing," Bigfoot said. "That's how they do it."
"I don't believe it," Call said. "We just ain't hit it good."
"Hit it good? We shot it 30 times, Gus said.
"That don't mean we hit it good," Call said.
Just as he said it, Gus's horse collapsed. He sank to the ground and rolled his eyes, his limbs trembling.
"Get him up. Get him up," Bigfoot instructed. "Get him up. If we don't, he'll die."
Gus began to jerk on the bridle rein, but the horse merely let him pull its head up.
Call grabbed its tail, and Bigfoot began to kick it and yell at it, but it did no good. The horse made no effort to regain its feet, and the three of them together could not lift it.
When they tried, expending all their strength, the horse's legs splayed out beneath it. The moment they loosened their hold, the horse fell heavily.
"Let it go. It ain't gonna live," Bigfoot said. "We should have reined up sooner. We'll be lucky if we all three don't die." The buffalo had run on for another 500 yards or so and stopped. It had not fallen, but at least it had stopped. Gus felt a fury building. Now, thanks to the aggravating buffalo, his horse was dying. He would have to walk to Santa Fe. "I'll kill it if I have to beat it to death," he said, grabbing his rifle in his bullet pouch.
"If it's a witch buff, you won't kill it. It will kill you," Bigfoot said. "Best thing to do with a witch buffalo is to leave it alone."
"He don't listen when he's mad," Call said. He unstrapped Gus's bedroll from the dying horse and brought it with him. Gus was striding on ahead, determined to walk straight up to the wounded buffalo and blow its brains out. He didn't believe an Indian could pray and dance and keep a buffalo from dying. Bigfoot could believe such foolery if he wanted to. Yet when he approached the buffalo, the animal turned and snorted. It lowered its head and pawed the ground. There was a bloody froth running out of its nose, but otherwise there was no evidence that the 30 bullets had weakened it seriously. It not only wasn't dead, it was showing fight. Gus knelt and carefully put a bullet right where he thought the buffalo's heart would be. He was only 20 yards away. He couldn't miss from such a distance. He fired again, a little higher, but with the same lack of result.
Leave it be. We've wasted enough ammunition, Bigfoot said. We need to save some of it for the Mexicans.
At this rate, we'll never see a Mexican, Carl said. He was losing his belief in their ability to find their way across the plain. It was too vast, and they had no map. Bigfoot admitted that he really didn't know where the New Mexican settlements were or how far ahead they might be. Before Carl could say more, Gus threw his rifle down and pulled his knife.
It's a weak gun. The bullets must not be going in far enough, Gus said. I'll kill the goddamn thing with this knife if that's all that will do it.
When he rushed the buffalo and began to stab it in the side, the beast made no attempt to run or fight. It merely stood there, its head down, blowing the bloody froth out of its nostrils.
By God, he's going to finish it. Let's help him, Bigfoot said, drawing his own knife.
Soon he had joined Gus and was stabbing at the buffalo's throat. Carl thought their behavior was crazy. There were only three of them. They couldn't eat that much of the buffalo even if they killed it. But for Bigfoot and Gus, the animal had become a kind of test. The two men could think of nothing but killing the animal. Unless they could kill it, they wouldn't be able to go on. The settlements would never be reached unless they could kill the buffalo. Carl drew his knife and approached the animal from the other side. It had a short, thick neck, but he knew the big vein had to be somewhere in it. If he could cut the big vein, the buffalo would eventually die, no matter how much praying and dancing the Comanches had done over it. He stabbed and drew blood, and so did Gus and Bigfoot. They stabbed until their arms were tired of lifting their knives, until they were all three covered with blood. Finally, red and panting from their efforts, they all three gave up. They stood a foot from the buffalo, completely exhausted, unable to kill it. As a last effort, Carl drew his pistol, stuck it against the buffalo's head just below the ear, and fired. The buffalo took one step forward and sank to its knees. All three men stepped back, thinking the animal would roll over, but it didn't. Its head sank, and it died, still on its knees.
If only there was a creek, I'd like to wash, Gus said.
He had never liked the smell of blood and was shocked to find himself covered with it in a place where there was no possibility of washing. They sank down on the prairie grass and rested, too tired to cut up their trophy.
How do Indians ever kill them? Carl asked, looking at the buffalo.
It seemed to be merely resting its head on its knees.
Why, with arrows, how else? Bigfoot asked.
Carl said nothing, but once again he felt a sense of trespass. It had taken three men, with rifles, pistols, and knives, an hour to kill one beast. Yet Indians did it with arrows alone. He had watched them kill several on the floor of the Palo Duro Canyon.
All buffalo ain't this hard, Bigfoot assured them. I've never seen one this hard.
Dern, I wish I could wash, Gus said. Bigfoot Wallace took only the buffalo's tongue and liver. The tongue he put in his saddlebag after sprinkling it with salt, first dripping a drop or two of fluid from the buffalo's gallbladder on the slices of meat.
A little gall makes it tasty, he said, offering the meat to Carl and Gus.
Carl ate three or four bites, Gus only one, which he soon quickly spat out.
Can't we cook it? He asked. I'm hungry, but not hungry enough to digest raw meat.
You'll be that hungry tomorrow unless we're lucky, Bigfoot said.
I'd just rather cook it,
Gus said again. It was clear from Bigfoot's manner that he regarded the request as absurdly fastidious.
I guess if you want to burn your clothes, you might get fire enough to singe a slice or two, Bigfoot said. He gestured toward the empty plain around them.
Nowhere within the reach of their eyes was there a plant, a bush, a tree that would yield even a stick of firewood. The plain was not entirely level, but it was entirely bare.
What a goddamn place this is, Gus said. A man has to tote his own firewood or else make do with raw meat.
No, there's buffalo chips if you want to hunt for them, Bigfoot said. I've cooked many a liver over buffalo chips, but there ain't many buffalo out this way. I don't feel like walking 10 miles to gather enough chips to keep you happy.
As they rode away from the dead buffalo, they saw two wolves trotting toward it. The wolves were a long way away, but the fact that there were two living creatures in sight on the plain was reassuring, particularly to Gus. He had been more comfortable in a troop of rangers than he was with only Carl and Bigfoot for company. They were just three human dots on the encircling plain. Bigfoot watched the wolves with interest. Wolves had to have water just as did men and women. The wolves didn't look lank either. There must be water within a few miles if only they knew which way to ride.
Wolves and coyotes ain't far from being dogs, he observed.
You always get coyotes hanging around a camp. They like people. Or at least they like to eat our leavings. The colonel ought to catch him a coyote pup or two and raise him to hunt for him. It'd take the place of that big dog you dropped.
Carl thought they were all likely to die of starvation. It was gallant of Bigfoot to speculate about the colonel and his pets when they were in such a desperate situation. The colonel was in the same situation, only worse. He had the whole troop to think of. He ought to be worrying about keeping the men from starving, not on replacing his big Irish dog. They rode all night. They had no water at all. They didn't ride fast, but they rode steadily.
When dawn flamed up along the great horizon to the east, they stopped to rest. Bigfoot offered the two of them slices of buffalo tongue. Call ate several bites, but Gus declined in favor of horse meat.
"I can't reconcile myself to eating a tongue," he said. "My ma would not approve. She raised me to be careful about what foods I stuff in my mouth."
Call wondered briefly what his own mother had been like. He had only one cloudy memory of her, sitting on the seat of a wagon. In fact, he was not even sure that the woman he remembered had been his mother. The woman might have been his aunt. In any case, his mother had given him no instructions in the matter of food. During the day's long, slow ride, the pangs of hunger were soon rendered insignificant beside the pangs of thirst. They had had no water for a day and a half. Bigfoot told them that if they found no water by the next morning, they would have to kill a horse and drink what was in its bladder. He instructed them to cut small strips of leather from their saddle strings and chew on them to produce a saliva flow. It was a stratagem that worked for a while. As they chewed the leather, they felt less thirsty, but the trick had a limit. By evening, their saliva had long since dried up. Their tongues were so swollen, it had become hard to close their lips. One of the worst elements of the agony of thirst was the thought of all the water they had wasted during the days of rain and times of plenty.
"I'd give 3 months' wages to be crossing the Brazos right now," Gus said. "I expect I could drink about half of it."
"Would you give up the gal in the general store for a drink?" Bigfoot asked. "Now that's the test." He winked at Call when he said it.
"I could drink half a river," Gus repeated.
He thought the question about Clara impertinent under the circumstances and did not intend to answer it. If he starved to death, he intended at least to spend his last thoughts on Clara. The next morning, the sorrel horse that Gus and Call had both been riding refused to move. The sorrel's eyes were wide and strange, and he did not respond either to blows or commands.
"No use to kick him or yell at him, he's done for," Bigfoot said, walking up to the horse.
Before Gus or Call could so much as blink, he drew his pistol and shot the horse. The sorrel dropped, and before he had stopped twitching, Bigfoot had his knife out, working to remove the bladder. He worked carefully so as not to nick it and soon lifted it out, a pale sack with a little liquid in it.
"I won't drink that," Gus said at once. The mere sight of the pale, slimy bladder caused his stomach to feel queasy.
"It's the only liquid we got," Bigfoot reminded him. "We'll all die if we don't drink it." He lifted up the bladder carefully and drank from it as he would from a wineskin. Call took it next, hesitating a moment before putting it to his mouth. He knew he wouldn't survive another waterless day. His swollen tongue was raw from scraping against his teeth. Quickly he shut his eyes and swallowed a few mouthfuls. The urine had more smell than taste. Once he judged he'd had his share, he handed the bladder to Gus. Gus took it, but after a moment shook his head. "You have to drink it," Carl told him. "Just drink 3 swallows. That might be enough to save you. If you die, I can't bury you. I'm too weak." Gus shook his head again. Then abruptly, his need for moisture overcame his revulsion, and he drank 3 swallows. He did not want to be left unburied on such a prairie. The coyotes and buzzards would be along, not to mention badgers and other varmints. Thinking about it proved worse than doing it. Soon they went on, Bigfoot astride the one remaining horse. That afternoon they came to a tiny waterhole, so small that Bigfoot could have stepped across, or could have had there not been a dead mule in the puddle. They all recognized the mule, too. Black Sam had an affection for it. In the early days of the expedition, he had sometimes fed it carrots. It had been stolen by the Comanches the night of the first raid.
"Why, that's John," Gus said. "Wasn't that what Black Sam called him?"
John had 2 arrows in him. Both were feathered with prairie chicken feathers, the arrows of buffalo hump.
"He led it here and killed it," Bigfoot said. "He didn't want us to drink this muddy water."
"He didn't want us to drink at all," Call said, looking at the arrows. I'll drink this water anyway, Gus said, but Bigfoot held him back. Don't, he said. That horse piss was clean compared to this water. Let's go. That night they had no appetite. Even a bite was more than any of them could choke down. Gus pulled out some rancid horse meat, looked at it, and threw it away, an action Bigfoot was quick to criticize. Go pick it up, he said. It might rain tonight. I've been smelling moisture, and my smeller don't often fail me. If we could get a little liquid in us, that horse meat might taste mighty good. About midnight, they heard thunder and began to see flashes of lightning far to the west. Gus was immediately joyful. He saw the drought had broken. Call was more careful. It wasn't raining, and the thunder was miles away. It might rain somewhere on the plain, but would it rain where they were? And would any water pool up so they could drink it? Boys, we're saved, Bigfoot said, watching the distant lightning. I may be saved, but I'm still thirsty, Gus said. I can't drink rain that's raining miles away. It's coming our direction, boys, Bigfoot said. He was wildly excited. Privately, he'd given the three of them up for lost, though he hadn't said as much to the young rangers. If the rain don't come to us, I'll go to the rain, Call said. Soon they could smell the rain. It began to cool the hot air. They were so thirsty was all they could do to keep from racing to meet the storm, although they had nothing to race on except one tired horse and their feet. Bigfoot had been right. The rain came. The only thing they had to catch it in was their hats. The hats weren't fully watertight, but they caught enough rainwater to allow the starving men to quench their thirst. Just wet your lips, don't gulp it. You'll get sick if you do, Bigfoot said. The lightning began to come closer. Soon it was striking within 100 yards of where they were huddled, then 50 yards. Call had never been much afraid of lightning, but as bolt after bolt split the sky, he began to wonder if he was too exposed. Let's get under the saddle, Gus said. Lightning spooked him. He'd heard that a lightning bolt had split a man in two and cooked both parts before the body even fell to the ground. He did not want to get split in two or cooked either, but he was not sure how to avoid it out on the bare plain. He sat very still, hoping the lightning would move on and not scorch anybody. Then a bolt seemed to hit almost right on Bigfoot. He wasn't hit, but he screamed anyway, screamed and clasped his hands over his eyes. Oh, Lord, he yelled into the darkness. I looked at it from too close. It burnt my eyes, and now I'm blind. Oh, Lord, blind, my eyes are scorched, Bigfoot screamed. Carl and Gus waited for another lightning bolt to show them Bigfoot. When it came, they just glimpsed it. He was wandering on the prairie, holding both hands over his eyes. Again, as darkness came back, he screamed like an animal. Keep your eyes shut. Don't look at the lightning, Carl said. Bigfoot's blind. That's trouble enough. Maybe he won't be blind too long, Gus said. With their scout blinded, what chance did they have of finding their way to some place in New Mexico where there were people? He thoroughly regretted his impulsive decision to leave with the expedition. Why hadn't he just stayed with Clara Forsyth and worked in a general store? Bigfoot screamed again. He was getting farther and farther away. Dark as it was, once the storm passed, they would have no way to follow him except by his screams. Call thought of yelling at him to tell him to sit down and wait for them, but if a man's eyes were scorched, he wouldn't listen. At least it's washing this darn blood off me, Gus said. Having to wear clothes encrusted with buffalo blood had been a heavy ordeal. For a few minutes, the lightning seemed to grow even more intense. Call and Gus sat still with their eyes tight shut, waiting for the storm to diminish. Some flashes were so strong and so close that the brightness shone through their clamped eyelids like a lantern through a thin cloth. Even after the storm moved east and the lightning and thunder diminished, Call and Gus didn't move for a while. The sound had been as heavy as the lightning had been bright. Call felt stunned. He knew he ought to be looking for Bigfoot, but he wasn't quick to move. I wonder where the horse went, Gus asked. He was right here when all this started, but now I don't see him. Of course you don't see him. It's dark, Call reminded him. I expect we can locate him in the morning. We'll need him for Bigfoot if he's still blind. Call yelled 3 or 4 times, hoping to get a sense of Bigfoot's position, but the scout didn't answer. You try. You've got a louder voice, Call said. Gus's ability to make himself heard over any din was well known among the rangers. But Gus's loudest yell brought the same result. Silence. Can you die from getting your eyes scorched? Gus asked. The same thought had occurred to Call. The lightning storm had been beyond anything in his experience. The shocks of thunder and lightning had seemed to shake the earth. Once or twice he thought his heart might stop just from the shock of the storm. What if it had happened to Bigfoot? He might be lying dead somewhere on the plain.
I hope he ain't dead, Gus said. If he's dead, we're in a pickle.
He could have just kept walking, Carl said. We know the settlements are north and west. If we keep going, we're bound to find a Mexican sometime.
They'll probably just shoot us, Gus said.
Why would they if it's just the two of us? Carl asked. We ain't an army. We're nearly out of bullets anyway.
They shot a bunch of Texans during the war, Gus recalled. Just lined them up and shot them. I heard they made them dig their own graves.
I wish we could just go back to Austin, he added.
Why can't we?
The colonel don't even know where we are. He's probably given up and gone back himself by now.
We've only got one horse and a few bullets, Carl reminded him. We'd never make it back across this plain.
Gus realized that what Carl said was true. He wished Bigfoot was there. Not much fazed Bigfoot. He missed the big scout.
Maybe Bigfoot ain't dead, he said.
I hope he ain't, Carl said. Bigfoot wasn't dead. As the storm was playing out, he lay down and pressed his face into the grass to protect his eyes. The grass was wet. Its coolness on his eyelids was some relief. While cooling his eyelids, he went to sleep. In the night, he rolled over. The first sunlight on his eyelids brought a searing pain. Gus and Carl were sleeping when they heard loud moans. Bigfoot had wandered about a half a mile from them before lying down. When they approached him, he had his head down, his eyes pressed against his arms.
It's like snow blindness, only worse, he told them. I've been snow blind. It'll go away in time. Maybe this will, too.
I expect it will, Carl said. Bigfoot was so sensitive to light that he had to keep his eyes completely covered.
You need to make me blinders, Bigfoot said. Blinders, and the thicker the better. Then put me on the horse.
Until that moment, Carl and Gus had both forgotten the horse, which was nowhere in sight.
I don't see that horse, Gus said. We might have lost him.
You go find him, Carl said to Gus. I'll stay with Bigfoot.
What if I find the horse and can't find you two?
Gus asked. The plain was featureless. He knew it to be full of dips and rolls, but once he got a certain distance, one dip and roll was much like another. He might not be able to find his way back to Carl and Bigfoot.
I'll go then, Carl said. You stay.
He won't be far, Bigfoot said. He was too tired to run far.
That assessment proved correct. Carl found the horse only about a mile away grazing. Carl had been painstakingly trying to keep his directions. He didn't want to lose his companions and was relieved when he saw the horse so close. By the time he got back, Gus had made Bigfoot a blindfold out of an old shirt. It took some adjusting. The slightest ray of light on his eyelids made Bigfoot moan. They ate the last of their horse meat and drank often during the day's march from the puddles here and there on the prairie. Toward the end of the day, Carl shot a goose, floating alone in one such small puddle.
A goose that's by itself is probably sick, Bigfoot said, but they ate the goose anyway.
They came to a creek with a few bushes and some small trees around it and were able to make a fire. The smell of the cooking goose made them all so hungry they could not sit still. They wanted to rip the goose off its spit before it was ready, yet they also had a great desire to eat cooked food. Bigfoot, who couldn't see but could certainly smell, asked Gus and Carl several times if the bird was almost ready. It was still half raw when they ate it, and yet to all of them it tasted better than any bird they had ever eaten. Bigfoot even cracked the bones to get at the marrow.
It's mountain man's butter, he said. Once you get a taste for it, you don't see why people bother to churn. It's better just to crack a bone.
Yeah, but you might not have a bone, Gus said. The bone might still be in the animal.
Bigfoot kept his eyes tightly bandaged, but he no longer moaned so much.
What will you do if you're blind from now on, Bigfoot? Gus asked.
Carl felt curious about the same thing, but did not feel it was appropriate to ask. Bigfoot Wallace had roamed the wilderness all his life. His survival had often depended on keenness of eye. A blind man would not last long in the wilderness. Bigfoot could scout no more. He would have to leave off scouting the troops. It would be a sad change if it happened.
Oh, I expect I'll get over being scorched, Bigfoot said.
Gus said no more, but the question still hung in the air. Bigfoot reflected for several minutes before commenting further.
If I'm blind, it will be goodbye to the prairies, he said. I expect I'd have to move to town and run a whorehouse.
Why a whorehouse? Gus asked.
Well, I couldn't see the merchandise, but I could feel it, Bigfoot said. Feel it and smell it and poke it.
I've been in whorehouses when I was too drunk to see much anyway, he added. You don't have to look to enjoy whores.
Speaking of whores, I wonder what they're like in Santa Fe, Gus asked.
Eating the goose had raised his spirits considerably. He felt sure that the worst was over.
He had even argued to Carl that the reason the goose had been so easy to shoot was that it was a tame goose that had run off from a nearby farm.
No, it was a sick goose, Carl insisted. There wouldn't be a farm around here. It's too dry.
Despite his friend's skepticism, Gus had begun to look forward to the delights of Santa Fe, one of which would undoubtedly be whores.
You can't afford no whore, even if we get there alive, Bigfoot reminded him.
I guess I could get a job until the colonel shows up, Gus said. Then we can rob the Mexicans and have plenty of money.
I don't know if the colonel will make it, Bigfoot said. I expect he'll starve or else turn back.
That night their horse was stolen. They were such a pitiful trio that no one had thought to stand guard. Eating the goose had put them all in a relaxed mood. The horse, in any case, was a poor one. It had never recovered fully from the wild chase after the buffalo. Its wind was broken. It plodded slowly along, carrying Bigfoot. Still, it had been their only mount, their only resource in more ways than one. They all knew they might need to eat it if they didn't make the settlement soon now. The goose had been a stroke of luck. There might not be another. Carl had hobbled the horse to make sure it didn't graze so far that he would have to risk getting lost by going to look for it in the morning. They called the horse Moonlight because of his light coat. Before Carl slept, he heard Moonlight grazing not far away. It was a reassuring sound, but then he slept. When he woke, the hobbles had been cut and there was no sign of Moonlight. The three of them were alone on the prairie.
We'll track 'em. They probably ain't far, Bigfoot said before he remembered that he was blind.
His eyes were paining him less, but he still didn't dare remove his blinders.
If he was close enough to steal Moonlight, he could have killed me, Carl said. The stealth Indians possessed continued to surprise him.
He was a light sleeper. The least thing woke him. But the horse thief had repeatedly come within a few steps of him, yet he had no inkling that anyone was near.
"Dern, it's a pity you boys don't know how to track," Bigfoot said. "I expect it was Kicking Wolf. That old hump man wouldn't follow us this far, not for one damn horse. Kicking Wolf was more persistent."
"Too damn persistent," Gus said.
He was affronted. Time and again the red man had bested them.
"All they'd done is beat us," he added. "It's time we beat them at something."
"Well, we can beat them at starving to death," Bigfoot said. "I don't know much else we can beat them at."
"Why didn't they kill us?" Carl asked.
"I doubt there was more than one of them. I expect it was just Kicking Wolf," Bigfoot said. "Stealing horses is quiet work, but killing men ain't. He might have woke one of us up and one of us might have got him."
"It's a long way to come for one damn horse," Gus commented. He still stung from the embarrassment of being so easily robbed.
"Kicking Wolf is horse crazy, like you're whore crazy. You'd go anywhere for a whore and he'd go anywhere for a horse."
"I don't know if I'd go halfway across a damn desert for a whore," Gus said. "I sure wouldn't for a worn-out horse like Moonlight. Kicking Wolf is crazier than me."
Bigfoot looked amused. "There's no law saying an Indian can't be crazier than a white man," he said.
All that day and for the next two, Carl and Gus took turns leading Bigfoot. It was tiring work. Bigfoot had a long stride, longer even than Gus's. The two of them had almost a trot to keep ahead of him. Then, too, the prairie was full of cracks and little gullies. They had to be alert to keep him on level ground. It annoyed him to stumble. It stormed again the second night, though with less lightning. Water puddled here and there. They were not thirsty, but once they finished the last few bites of horse meat, they had no food. Carl was afraid to roam too far to hunt, for fear of losing Gus and Bigfoot. In any case, they saw no game except a solitary antelope. The antelope was in sight for several hours. Gus thought it was only about 3 miles away, but Carl thought it might be farther. In the thin air, distances were hard to judge.
Bigfoot considered it peculiar that the antelope stayed in sight so long. Not to be able to use his own eyes was frustrating. "If I could just have one look, I could give an opinion," he said. "It might not even be an antelope. Remember them mountain goats that turned into Comanches?"
Reminded, Gus and Carl gave the distant animal their best scrutiny. Gus was of the opinion that the animal might be a Comanche, but Carl was convinced it was just a plain antelope.
"Go stalk it, then," Bigfoot said. "We'll sit down and wait. A little antelope rump would be mighty tasty."
"Let Gus stalk it," Carl said. "He's got better eyes. I'll wait with you." Gus didn't relish the assignment. If the antelope turned out to be a Comanche, he would be in trouble. He was hungry, though. So were the others.
"Don't shoot until you've got a close shot," Bigfoot said. "If you can't hit the heart, shoot for the shoulder. That'll slow him down enough that we can catch him."
Gus stalked the antelope for 3 hours. The last 300 yards he edged on his belly. The antelope lifted its head from time to time and mostly kept grazing. Gus got closer and closer. He remembered that he had missed the first antelope at almost point-blank range. He wanted to get very close. It would do his pride good to bring home some meat, and his belly would appreciate it, too. He got to within 200 yards, but decided to edge a little closer. He thought he might hit it at 150 yards. He kept his head down so as not to show the animal his face. Bigfoot had informed him that prairie animals were particularly alarmed by white faces. Indians could get close enough to kill them because their faces weren't white. He kept his hat low, and his face low, too. When he judged he was within about the right distance, he risked a peek and, to his dismay, saw no antelope. He looked, then stood up and looked, but the antelope was gone. Gus ran toward where it had been standing, thinking the animal would have lain down. Then he glimpsed it running far to the north, farther than it had been when they had first noticed it. Following it would be pointless. For a moment, stumbling around after the antelope, he felt panic take him. He could not be sure which direction he had come from. He might not even be able to find Bigfoot and Carl. Then he remembered a rock that stuck up a little from the ground. He had passed it in his crawl. He walked in a half circle until he saw the rock and was soon back on the right course. Even so, he was disgusted when he got back to his companions. "I wasted all that time," he said. He took off and ran. "Let's just hurry up and get to New Mexico."
"Oh, we're in New Mexico," Bigfoot said. "We just ain't the right part of it yet. My eyes are improving, at least. Pretty soon I won't have to be led."
Bigfoot's eyes did improve, even as their bellies grew emptier. On the third day after the storm, he was able to take his blinders off in the late afternoon. Soon afterward, he found a small patch of wild onions and dug out enough for them to have a few each to nibble. It wasn't much, but it was something. The next morning, waking early, Gus saw the mountains. At first he thought the shapes far to the north might be clouds, storm clouds. Once the sun was well up, he saw that the shapes were mountains. Carl saw them, too. Bigfoot still had to be careful of his eyes in full light. He wanted to look, but had to give up.
"If it's the mountains, then we're saved, boys," he said. "There's got to be people between here and the hills."
They walked all day, though, without food. The mountains seemed none the less distant. "What if we ain't saved?" Gus whispered to Carl. "I'm hungry enough to eat tongue or bugs or anything I can catch. Them mountains could be 50 miles away for all we know. I ain't gonna last no 50 miles, not unless I get food."
"I guess you'll last if you have to," Carl told him. "Bigfoot says we'll come to villages before we get to the hills. Maybe we'll only be 20 miles or 30.
"I could eat my belt," Gus said. He actually cut a small slice off his belt and ate it, or at least chewed it and swallowed it. The result didn't please him, though. The little slice of leather did nothing to relieve his hunger pangs. They walked steadily all day toward the mountains. They ignored their stomachs as best they could, but there were moments when Carl thought Gus might be right. They might starve before they reached the villages. Bigfoot had taken a fever somehow. Most of the day he stumbled along delirious. He seemed to think he was talking to James Bowie, the gallant fighter who had died at the Alamo.
"We ain't him, we're just us," Gus told him several times, but Bigfoot kept on talking to James Bowie.
Toward the evening of that day, as the shadows from the mountains stretched across the plain, Gus thought he saw something encouraging, a thin column of smoke rising into the shadows. He looked again, and again he saw smoke. "It's from a chimney," he said. "There's a house with a chimney up there somewhere." Carl saw the smoke, too, and Bigfoot claimed he smelled it.
"That's wood smoke, all right," he said. "I reckon it's pinyon. They use pinyon for fires out here in New Mexico."
They hurried for 3 miles and still weren't to the village. Just as they were about to get discouraged again, they came over a little rise in the ground and saw 40 or 50 sheep grazing on the plain ahead. A dog began to bark. 2 sheep herders, just making their campfire, looked up and saw them. The sheep herders were unarmed and took fright at the sight of the 3 rangers.
"I expect they think we're devils," Bigfoot said, as the 2 sheep herders hurried off toward a village 1 or 2 away.
The sheep they left in care of the 2 large dogs, both of whom were barking and snarling at the Texans.
"They didn't need to run. I'm just glad to be here," Gus said. In fact, he was so moved by the sight of the distant houses that he felt he might weep. Crossing the prairie, he'd often wondered if he would ever see a house again, or sleep in one, or ever be among people again at all. The empty spaces had given him a longing for normal things. Women cooking, children chasing one another, blacksmiths shoeing horses, men drinking in bars. Several times on the journey he had thought such things were lost forever. He would never get across the plain to sit at a woman's table again, but now he had.
Carl was glad to come to the village, too. He had been hearing about New Mexico for months, and yet until they spotted the sheep herders had not seen a single Mexican. He had begun to doubt that there were towns in New Mexico at all.
"I wouldn't mind stopping and cooking one of them sheep right now," Bigfoot said. "I guess that wouldn't be friendly, though. Maybe they'll cook one for us once they see we ain't devils."
"They may think we're devils even if we're friendly," Gus said. "I could use a barbering, and so could the rest of you."
Carl knew he was right. They were filthy and shaggy. They had only their guns and the clothes they had on, and they were afoot. Who but devils would emerge from the great plain afoot? They gave the sheep a wide berth. The big dogs acted as if they might charge at the slightest provocation. None of them fell in the mood for a dogfight.
"I've always wondered why people keep dogs," Bigfoot said. "Now the Indians, they eat puppies, and a puppy might be tasty. But a big dog is only a step from being a wolf, and it's foolish to get too close to wolves."
The village consisted of about 20 houses, all of them made of brown adobe. Long before the 3 of them arrived, the whole village had gathered to watch their approach. The men, the women, the children stood in one group, clearly apprehensive. 1 or 2 of the men had old guns.
"By God, I guess Caleb could conquer this state if he gets here," Bigfoot said. "They don't even have a gun apiece, and I doubt they know how to shoot anyway."
"Don't be talking of conquering them," Gus said. The mention of mutton had made him realize how hungry he was. He didn't want to lose his chance for a good meal because of any foolish talk about military matters. Let the conquering wait until they had eaten their fill.
"Wave at them, let them know we're friendly," Bigfoot said. "They don't look hostile, but there might be a show-off who wants to impress a gal. That's usually what starts a fight in situations like this."
They walked into the village slowly, giving evident signs that their intentions were friendly. Some of the little children hid their faces in their mother's skirts. Most of the women kept their faces down. Only a few bold little girls stared at the strangers. The men stood still as statues.
"This is when I wish I was better at the Spanish lingo," Bigfoot said. "I know some words, but I can't seem to get my tongue around them right."
"Just name off some grub," Gus advised. "Frijoles or tortillas or cabrito or something. I'm mostly interested in getting a meal and getting it soon."
They walked on, smiling at the assembled people, until they were at the center of the little village near the common well. A bucket of water had just been brought up. Bigfoot looked around and smiled before asking if they might drink.
"Agua?" he asked.
He addressed the question to an old man standing near the well. The old man looked embarrassed. He didn't raise his eyes.
"Certainly. You may drink your fill. It's a very long walk from Texas," a forceful voice said from behind them.
They turned to see 10 muskets pointed at them. A little group of militia had been hiding behind one of the adobe houses. The man who spoke stood somewhat to the side. He wore a military cap and had a thin mustache.
"What's this? We just want a drink," Bigfoot said.
He looked chagrined. Once again, they had been easily ambushed.
"You can have the drink, but I must ask you to lay down your arms first," the large man said firmly.
"Who are you?" Bigfoot asked. "We just walked in. We're friendly. Why point a bunch of guns at us?"
"I am Captain Salazar," the man said. "Lay down your weapons and you will come to no harm."
Bigfoot hesitated a moment. So did Gus and Carl. Although 10 rifles were pointed at them at a distance of no more than 30 feet, they didn't want to lay down their arms. There was dead silence in the village for several moments while the rangers considered the order. Captain Salazar waited. He was smiling, but it was not a friendly smile. The soldiers had their rifles ready to fire.
Now this is a fine weapon.